history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, the stories are there, stories that should not go untold. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And when we set out to do that, we're better off for it. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Over the next month, the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. will hold ceremonies to mark the 75th anniversaries of some significant World War II moments, like the Battle of the Colmar Pocket, the Battle of Manila, and of course, the Battle of Iwo Jima. But this week marks the 75th anniversary of an incident aboard the aircraft carrier USS Ticonderoga that we're going to focus on today. More than 100 men out of the ship's 3,000-man crew were killed or wounded in a pair of kamikaze attacks that day. We heard about it on this show a year and a half ago from one of the last survivors, a plank owner even, from the Ticonderoga, who at the time had never had the opportunity to talk to the family of his best friend who died that day. That is no longer the case, and we're going to update that for you today, and also hear from the nephew of that Gold Star hero and learn where his legacy will be preserved. So to set the stage for that latest twist, we need the story of what happened 75 years ago on January 21st, 1945. And there's no one better equipped to tell it than Bob Mettauer of Santa Maria, California, originally from Queens Village, New York. While his parents and twin sister were praying for him back home in the Big Apple, Bob found himself in the Pacific aboard the Big T, the USS Ticonderoga.
It was the largest aircraft carrier in the world at that time. We had a crew of over 3,000 people, and yes, you know, it was amazing. And of course, you know, you're young, so you just go ahead and do what you have to do.
And everybody has a little different role among that 3,000-man crew. So what was yours? What were your duties on the ship?
Well, I started out in the hydraulic gang, and that was steering gear, anchor windlass, and the elevators that moved the plane from the hangar deck to the flight deck. And I was in the number one elevator pump room, which was way forward, way down in the bilge. And my job there was, when they blew flight quarters, my job was to go down into the pump room and push a button, wait till the pressure got high, open up a valve, and then call up topside and tell them we're ready to go. And they were kind enough to call me in when I talked to them. They said, well, come on up. So I ran all the way from the bilge all the way up to the flight deck, and on the starboard side, the controls for the forward elevator were on the side of the flight deck. And we stood in gratings, look down through where you look through to the water, and that was how they operated with the buttons on the side of the elevator. The ship was loaded with planes, so they couldn't take off by themselves, so they had to be catapulted off. And when they catapulted the planes off, the wing would go right over our head as we were standing there.
I bet that's an experience nothing prepares you for.
No, that's right. It's quite exciting, really. And then they didn't just go, they didn't go right off. They dipped down and went down, and fortunately, there was 60 feet from the flight deck to the water, and they would probably go down to almost touch the water before they would have speed to go on, gone up.
So you're aboard this ship, brand new ship. You just told us what your original role was. What about your first experience with what war is really like, your first taste of an enemy to deal with?
Well, on January 21st in 1945, we had just finished bombing Saigon. So we're down there, and we were coming out to go back to another assignment. We were coming out, we're between the Philippines and Formosa, when we took two kamikazes. And my role there was, they blew general quarters, of course, and my role was to go to the forward mess hall. That was my battle station. And when we got there, the place was full of water up to your knees. And so the first thing we had to do was to get the hatch closed where the water was coming down from the flight deck. And having done that, then we were okay. And we were communicating with Battle Control. So Battle Control told us to get out of there and move to another compartment, which we did, and was dry there. And by this time, there was smoke all over the place. The smoke was being brought in by the blowers that would normally air the place. And we had to put on our gas mask, and the lights were out. So that's where we were. And then Battle Control told us they lost contact with the compartment behind where we originally were, and asked us to go in there and see what was going on. So I think I was one of the first ones that went in. And there was a gentleman, was a chow hall. So this gentleman was sitting there with a pen light flashlight in his hand, and it was on. So I thought he was okay, and I went and picked up one of the other people and took him down to sick bay because they were overcome. They had no gas mask on. And I went back into the compartment. That guy was still sitting there with the flashlight. So I said, "You better get out of here," and he was out cold. So I took him to sick bay.
And when you say take him to sick bay, you had to carry him?
Yes. And then on the second trip, I heard his voice, and it was Eddie Mazur, my best friend. We both worked in the machine shop, and we made weights. He was a body specimen, and we made weights, and I had set aside an apartment up forward above the flight the hangar deck. And when they blew general quarters, he was coming down a ladder when the first plane went through the flight deck and exploded in the hangar deck and made a piece of charcoal out of Eddie. It was terrible to see.
Well, as I was listening to you describe this, I'm thinking all of this was terrible to see. And what prepares you for that? I mean, you're a 20-year-old kid. Had you guys even experienced anything like this before? Had you seen other ships get hit by kamikazes? Did you know that threat was there?
No, I never saw it, but we knew the threat because we had heard about it. You know, the experience of seeing Eddie, it was immediately I knew there was nothing I could do. So I had to continue doing what I was doing to help the other people. And I still remember that. They'll never leave me.
And this was the guy that you'd spent a lot of time with, that you were probably with just the day before?
Yes, we were in the machine shop. We used to do things together. What he did was he made me cross my arms and cross my legs, and he'd pick me up and press me like I was a weight. That was the kind of a specimen he was. Wonderful young man.
So you come into that hold, that room, and you see him burnt to a crisp. You know he's already gone.
Yes. I knew it, and actually, he's listed as missing in action in this in my book.
I wonder if that's ever been corrected.
I have no way of knowing, but I knew when I saw him, I knew he wasn't missing in action. He was doomed.
And what do you do in a situation like that? I'm sure there's a lot of emotions that come over you, but you're still expected to perform a job.
Exactly, that's just exactly what it was. And there I was helping people out of the other compartment. I just continued to do that. And then, of course, pretty soon, things calmed down, and they told us to go back to our original location, which was, in my case, was the machine shop. And on the way back there, myself and Thompson, who was walking with me, we found my friend Chuck Lodge. And he was without his gas mask. It had expired, and he was having real problems. So he and I, we used my gas mask back and forth so that he could get some fresh air until we got back to the machine shop. And when we got to the machine shop, it looked like nothing had happened at all. It was amazing.
And somewhere in there, there was another job that you ended up with, a pretty gruesome task to help some other sailors who had been injured. What about the bigger picture? I mean, as this is happening, you talk about the smoke everywhere, you're seeing some of the damage to shipmates, including your best friend who's killed. Are you wondering if your ship's going to make it? If you guys might even be sunk by this attack?
No, there was never any threat of that. We weren't worried about it, that at all.
Even though you got hit by two kamikazes?
Right. Well, they didn't damage the hull. You know, the ship itself was intact. All they did was damage the flight deck. So the ship was intact, so there was nothing to worry about.
And maybe before we get to your job of prying these rings off of guys whose hands are burned, maybe you can explain to us where those kamikazes hit on the ship and the extent of the damage. I know you've got some photos in this book that you shared with high school kids before, but for our listeners, paint that picture of where the planes hit and the damage that occurred.
Well, at that time, I had no idea. It wasn't until afterwards that I was able to go up topside and find out what happened. So I had no idea. But what one of them went through the flight deck. It was forward of the island and on the starboard side. Went right through the flight deck and exploded in the hangar deck. And the other one hit the fire control turret on the island just above where Dixie Kiefer, our skipper, was, and injured him pretty badly, so he had to be taken off the ship.
In fact, in your book, which they produced right at the end of the war, there's a picture of the skipper of the ship, Dixie Kiefer, with a microphone in his hand in a hospital bed and people all around him. What was happening there?
Well, he was so badly injured, they were taking him off to put him on a hospital ship. And he was saying farewell to his crews and you know, keep up the good work and all of that. And there wasn't a dry eye on that ship when he left. He was such a fine man, great leader. And he became a world hero, a national hero.
Well, and you say there wasn't a dry eye on the ship. So I'm wondering, where were you while that was happening? And were you hearing this come over the PA system?
Yeah, I was down in the machine shop. I was down there when it happened. He came over the PA system, and everybody on his ship could hear him. And it was amazing because he was just a wonderful person, a wonderful leader.
Yeah, and I guess, and again, we're bouncing back and forth here a little bit, but I'm just thinking, if I'm a 20-year-old kid, and I've just been through all this, the damage to the ship, knowing how many guys were killed, including my best friend, and then I hear my skipper get on the PA, knowing that he's been wounded and he's getting carried off, did what he had to say help you process the situation you were in or motivate you for what you were going to be dealing with?
Well, to be honest, we were prepared for anything anyway. And the problem was when he was replaced, it just changed the entire attitude on the ship. Everything was different. The morale was different, and the person that took his place was not nearly the man that Dixie Kiefer was.
Well, let's talk some more about January 21st. So you told us some of what you experienced that day, and I'm sure it felt like a pretty long day. I think they hit you around noon, is that right?
Yeah, it was early in the day, yes.
So for the next several hours, it was probably nonstop action and busyness for you?
Well, it didn't, you know, really it didn't last that long, you know, because it happened so fast, and we were able to straighten everything out and get the fires out, and I would say probably an hour, that's all. And by that time, we were back in the machine shop.
And there's a book. You mentioned your daughter found a book where she works, the USS Ticonderoga book that has a lot of firsthand accounts from the men of the ship in there, and yours is in there. And there's something that you don't mention, but if I flip a few guys further and find Vern Rampa's account, he talks about a pretty gruesome assignment that the two of you had to carry out. What happened there?
Well, we received a phone call from sick bay about the men, some of the men that had, their hands were severely burned, and the ring was still on their finger, and it was killing them, the pain. So they called us up and asked if anything we could do. So my chief, Vern Rampa, said, yeah, let's send them up. So they sent us to the machine shop. And what I had a rag full of cold water and a long-nosed pair of pliers. And I had to dig deep into the wound, the burn, and lift that ring out so that Vern Rampa could grind it and cut it in half and we could take it off. And I think we did five or six of them.
And you had to do this because if you don't do that, they're going to lose those ring fingers. But what were those guys going through? I mean, are they screaming in pain? Are they gritting their teeth? And what did that feel like for you to be sticking those pliers in there?
Well, they were they were men, you know. They weren't crying. They knew we were trying to do the job, and that's what we did. And, you know what? It doesn't take long before you become a man when you're in the service. And that's what happens, you know. We're no longer kids. We're men.
And I know this is a little extraneous, but I'm thinking there might be some wives out there who are saying, well, did they save those wedding rings or did they get rid of them?
I have no idea what happened to them.
Wasn't a priority at that point, huh?
No, not at all.
And you mentioned that during this whole time, you still haven't seen the damage that those kamikazes inflicted. When you did, when you got topside and you saw with your own eyes the aftermath, the damage, the devastation, what was that like for you?
Well, of course, you know, I was amazed, but by that time, it was all over. Now, there you go again, you know. You're men, you just have to go around and do what you have to do to take care of everything and make sure everything goes back to normal, and that's what we did.
Did you do something to recognize or honor or memorialize the guys who had been killed?
Well, the people were killed. There's nothing we could do for them. So they had a ceremony, and it was nothing we could do. We had nothing that we could do for the poor dead people. And who knew how long we were going to stay out at sea? Nobody knew that. So they had a program where they buried them at sea. And they covered them up, and they just... They were in a stretcher or something like that, and they tilted the stretcher, and the poor boys went overseas into the ocean, and it was not a very pleasant thing to see.
Well, and you've already told us your best friend was one of them, but is there also part of you that where it registers, hey, that could be me that they're dropping into the water?
Well, of course, that could have happened to anybody. Fortunately, I was down below decks, and I didn't have any problems at all, personally. Of course, I told you the story about what we had to do.
Have you ever gone to any ship's reunions for the Ticonderoga?
Yes, we did. My wife received a phone call, and it was from a man that was helping to try to organize a group for the veterans group. He said to my wife, is it possible your husband was in the Navy during World War II? And she said, yes. Is it possible that he served aboard the USS Ticonderoga? She said, yes. And he said to her, wonderful. He said, my name is Harold Crane, but he says, I changed my name. It used to be Krinowitz. And she says, oh, Stinky Krinowitz. And that's how we got involved with the Veterans Association, and we're all over the place, and they still do it today. But I don't go any longer because there's nobody I know anymore. They're all gone.
Well, and one of the reasons I asked about the reunions, I was wondering if you ever encountered any of those guys whose fingers you saved by getting their rings off.
I don't think I ever did.
Have you ever wondered what happened to them and how their lives turned out?
No, I knew they were okay. You know, you should have seen the expression on their face when those rings came off.
Relief or pain?
Relief and pain.
Well, and the other thing that I have to ask you about, and I understand maybe it's not something that's easy to talk about, but your friend Eddie Mazur, I'm sure that experience as a 20-year-old is not something that anything could prepare you for. But in all the years since, have you ever thought, what would Eddie have done with his life? What kind of a human being, what kind of an American would he have been?
Well, I knew what kind of American he was and what kind of a human he was. But I'm sure he was pretty clever. I'm sure he would have made a fine living for himself.
And pretty strong, it sounds like, too.
Yes, he was.
You know, he's one of the more than 406,000 Americans who lost their lives in World War II. That's so long ago and so far away, and for most of the people listening, before they were even born. So what do we need to know about those men? How should they be remembered today?
Well, I think everybody remembers them the same way. They were all heroes. They were all heroes. And even today, I wear my World War II cap, and I have people come over to me and say thank you for your service.
And we had the chance to share those words with Bob when we met him in September of 2018 and shared that story with you here on the radio. At the time, he was approaching 95,000 miles on his bicycle and shooting for 100,000. But he had never gotten to talk to the family of his best friend, Eddie Mazur, who gave his life for our country 75 years ago this week. That is no longer the case, and we'll explain when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, focusing today on the 75th anniversary of the day the aircraft carrier USS Ticonderoga was struck by not one, but two kamikazes. You heard about what happened from Bob Mettauer, one of the last surviving members of that ship's crew. But when his story first aired here, he had not connected with the family of his best friend who was killed that day. Soon after Bob appeared on Hometown Heroes, that connection was made. And since then, he's had many conversations with Eddie Mazur's nephew, Fred, who had composed an online tribute to the hero he never met. We don't get to do something like this too often on the show, but now on the phone, we have Fred Mazur from Pennsylvania and now 95-year-old Bob Mettauer from Santa Maria, California, and we're going to understand a little more about how both of these families were affected. Well, Bob, January 21st will mark the 75th anniversary of that day aboard the Ticonderoga when the two kamikazes hit your ship.
Right.
How often over those 75 years have you thought about that day?
Well, you know, I'll be honest with you, I think of it a lot. I read a lot of World War II books, and of course, doing that, it brings back that experience.
And when we talked the first time, you told me that you lost your best friend that day, Eddie Mazur.
That's true.
When you think about him now, what are the things, what are the images or the memories or the thoughts that come through your mind?
Well, one of the things that comes out, that he taught me how to stand on my head, you know, hang by my toes. We had a punching bag in the machine shop, and he taught me how to use the punching bag, you know, and he did a lot of stuff like that for me.
Fred, growing up, what did you hear about your Uncle Ed? What was the extent of your knowledge or awareness of him?
Well, my father came from a very large family. He was one of 12 children. He was right in the middle of the 12. Eddie was the youngest. Christmas and Easter and all the holidays, we would go over to grandmother's, and all the siblings would be over there, and then all their children, which were my cousins, were there. So we had a very large gathering every holiday. So Eddie came up in conversation every time, just stories upon stories about how intelligent he was, how talented he was, how athletic he was. At that time, he had set track and field records at New Kensington High School in New Kensington, Pennsylvania. And in fact, when I was a young boy, somebody in the family had home movies, and I'm guessing it was probably 8mm format. I don't think that's what it was. And there were movies of him going up and down the steps at my grandmother's on his hands. And he was so athletic. He could walk up and down steps faster on his hands than most people could go up and down on their feet. And that was just one of many things he could do. He was very acrobatic. He was very strong. Bob told me a story once that he would use Bob Mettauer as a weight. He would pick him up like Bob would put cross his arms on his chest, cross his legs, and then Eddie would bench press Bob. That's how strong Ed was.
As a matter of fact, I used to do that with my daughters.
Because he taught you how to do it?
Yeah. Well, I've seen a broad jump 18 inches on his hands.
Yeah, he was amazing. Anyhow, the word was, and I think Bob told us this too earlier, was that Ed was up on the deck of the Ticonderoga doing his exercises and doing his acrobatics up on the deck when the Japanese suicide planes came in. And Ed was on his way down to his station in the machine shop, and he didn't make it. Bob, you would know better what that was, a ladder that went down to the floor down below, and I guess he was in that tube whenever the plane hit.
And what they were doing, we made weights. We made weights in a machine shop at night, and they had this this room up, or, you know, some kind of a compartment set aside for them to lift the weights and do their exercises, and that's where he was. And when he came down the ladder, it was an enclosed ladder, you know, it had sides to it. And that's where he was when the plane exploded on the hangar deck.
So he was just enveloped and engulfed in flames. And when you saw him, he was very badly burned, but still able to communicate.
You know, later on, I was taking people from a compartment that were all overcome from, they didn't have the gas mask on. I was taking people into the sick bay. And when I took the second person in, I heard Eddie's voice, and I saw him, and he was in one of the bunks. You know, they had these nice, comfortable places for the ill to be, and he was right there. You know, the second one, and I looked at him, and I couldn't do anything. There wasn't anything I could do, you know, and I could see that he wasn't going to last, you know. And so I just went back out and got another guy to take back in there, you know, and that's how I remember it.
You know, and I was trying to remember, Bob, the first time we talked and you told me that story. You weren't looking for attention for it, but you made it very clear that you had to carry some of those guys out of there who had been overcome by the fumes and had passed out.
Right.
Were you ever decorated for that?
No.
Because that's the kind of thing that a lot of guys were decorated for.
Well, and, maybe, you know, but yeah. I don't think anybody ever knew about it.
Mm-hmm.
Except the people maybe that I carried in there.
I'm sure they haven't forgotten. Some of them may be wondering how in the world they got out of there. They may not even know that you carried them.
Right.
I know we're bouncing around here, but let me come back to Fred. So, Fred, you grow up with this awareness of your uncle, the war hero, who made the ultimate sacrifice, made your family a Gold Star family. What significance did that hold in your life, and what was it that prompted you to create a tribute to him online eventually?
Well, Eddie died for the freedoms that we all enjoy, and that touched me. I'm sorry, I'm a little emotional here. Eddie was a man that I never knew. I never shook his hand. I never hugged him, but it was like he was always there. The stories just kept going on, and the family so missed him. You could tell at every holiday event that he was in their hearts and their minds. So anyhow, I was given his Purple Heart from my Uncle Walter, who had it. When Walter passed away in the late 90s, he gifted me his Purple Heart, and I've kept it close to me. In fact, I've had it on display in my house for years. But as I start to age, I mean, I'll be 70 this year, which isn't maybe, you know, real old, but how many more years do we have? And I wanted to make sure that Eddie's sacrifice was memorialized. My cousins and I went on to talked to a gentleman down in Pittsburgh by the name of Michael Krause, and he's a curator for Soldiers and Sailors Hall. It's a memorial for soldiers and sailors. It's an amazing building. And anyhow, we donated all of his uniforms, artifacts, letters from home, letters that he sent to my grandmother, and took everything down to Soldiers and Sailors and donated it. And later on, you'll be able to chat with Michael Krause. And I just felt that Eddie's sacrifice had to be memorialized. It could not be forgotten. And he's just one of hundreds of thousands of men that gave their lives. But it's a story of a local man that had so much to live for, was so talented, and his life was cut short, saving, you know, our freedoms for us. I knew I had to do something to memorialize memorialize his sacrifice. So I have cousins that I keep in touch with. The oldest cousin I have is a gentleman by the name of John Nikowski, and he lives down in Houston, Texas. He's 89 years old, and he was only about 5 or 6 years younger than Eddie, and those two played together. He could probably tell you some stories firsthand, the time he spent together with Ed. And then I have another cousin by the name of Ed Sheba, and Eddie is Eddie Mazur's namesake. He was named after Eddie. And I have another cousin by the name of Karen Greenlee. She is the daughter of Eddie's sister, Wanda. Oh, one more, and probably most important. It's the daughter-in-law of my cousin, Bob Kuntz. And her name is Irene Kuntz. And you can't imagine the amount of research that she did to put together. And anyhow, we decided that the best way to do this was to give it to Soldiers and Sailors Hall and let them memorialize Eddie. And that's forthcoming, and I guess there'll be more on that later.
Yeah. All right, so Bob, because Fred had put that online tribute to his uncle, that's how the two of you got connected. It had been there for years, but you weren't aware of it. And then you finally had a chance to talk to a member of Eddie's family. What was that like for you all those years later to connect with Fred and to go back and forth with him?
Well, it was interesting, you know. Years had passed, and Eddie had kind of disappeared in my life, and now here all of a sudden, there he is again, you know. So it's kind of interesting.
Bob, I have to tell you this. When we went through all those artifacts that we donated to Soldiers and Sailors, you composed a letter and sent it to my grandmother, and that's in the artifacts that are going to be down there. You expressed your sympathy for the loss of your friend and her son.
Right. I remember that.
Well, that letter is alive, and it will be in the memorial. I didn't know if you knew that.
Yeah, that's something.
When we met you the first time, one of the things that you'd kind of become well known for in Santa Maria was riding your bike everywhere, Bicycle Bob. So how many miles are you up to now?
Well, I told you I had a fall, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm temporarily not doing anything. But I think maybe about 20 to 40 miles from 99,000 miles.
So what are you going to do once you get to 100,000?
We'll see. The way I'm not right now, after the fall I had, I can't even go near the bike.
Something tells me you're going to get back up on it, though, knowing you.
I would guess that I will, yes.
You know, before we wrap it up, I'd just like to hear from both of you, just your real feelings about what it's meant to connect all these years after a really tragic day that changed both of your lives. One of you wasn't born yet, but it really did impact both of your lives. What has the connection you two now share meant to both of you?
Well, if I may speak first, I want to thank Bob for service to his country, and I want to thank Bob for being my uncle's best friend. Because my uncle, from all accounts, was one of the best people you'd ever want to meet. I'm sure he held Bob dear as a friend. I thank you, Bob. Your sacrifice to this country also is much appreciated by all. God bless you, and keep riding that bike.
thank you very much for that. You know, Eddie was a special person. I felt fortunate that I was able to know him, and I just wish that things had changed, you know. What happened didn't happen, you know, but there's nothing he can do about that. It's a pleasure to have, you know, be able to have to reconnect with Eddie's family, but as I say, nothing he can do now to bring him back.
But we can honor his legacy and tell his story, and that's exactly what's happening. It's time for another break. When we come back, we'll hear more about the special place where Eddie Mazur's story will have the chance to bring perspective and inspiration to many. You can find photos related to this episode at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
inspiring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, marking 75 years since a kamikaze attack on the aircraft carrier USS Ticonderoga left more than 100 men killed or wounded. You heard from Bob Mettauer, who cared for some of the wounded and incapacitated, but was faced with the realization that he could do nothing to save his best friend, Eddie Mazur. After Bob shared his story on Hometown Heroes, he was able to finally connect to Eddie's family and has since gotten to know Fred Mazur, Eddie's nephew, quite well. You heard from both Bob and Fred, and in a moment you'll hear from the curator of the museum now charged with honoring that Gold Star hero's legacy. But first, I want to give Fred Mazur the chance to share anything more about that uncle he never had the opportunity to meet. Fred?
Well, you know, I just touched on Eddie's athletic prowess, but he was training as a machinist with Westinghouse in Pittsburgh. He was so well respected. He was very intelligent, as you could read in a lot of these letters that we donated to soldiers and sailors, that there were people really crushed by the loss of him because he had so much to offer the world. You know, you just wonder what could have been had he stayed alive. But, you know, time goes on and we didn't have him. And you can only wonder what might have been, you know.
And I'm looking forward to taking a look the next time I'm in Pittsburgh. What are you hoping? The people who see that, people who come across that, who read and hear and are learning about your uncle, what are you hoping they get out of that? What are you hoping they come away with?
Well, here's a hero, a local hero in Pittsburgh. He lived only about 20 miles away. I'm sure that this will touch the hearts of people in the Ellicottski Valley, which is where we live, and that's New Kensington is part of it. Just a story of a local hero. It's a good story. And I think people would be interested in it. I hope you make it to Pittsburgh, and I hope that you can look at some of the artifacts that we gathered. I mean, up there is a gigantic room with this gigantic table and a whole bunch of chairs, and we had everything spread out up there. I mean, uniforms and Purple Heart and letters and the diary. When the Ticonderoga was built, it sailed out of Portsmouth, Virginia, and went down through the Panama Canal, up the other side, and went to California before it shipped out to the Pacific, where Eddie eventually met his demise. But he has a diary, that whole thing, and that's down there, too.
Wow.
Well, I am so glad that you found me and put me in touch with Bob, because this got everything going again. You know, it had kind of dropped off with me, too, except on January 21st, which, by the way, is the birthday of my baby girl. So she's in her early 30s, and every birthday for the past 30 years, I mean, Eddie comes to mind. So it re-enters your mind. You know, it never goes away. I think of him a lot. I wish I would have known him. Maybe in another life, another time, maybe I will meet him in my heart, and I hope that happens. So he's a guy at the top of my list I want to meet.
Amen. And he's on my list now, too. That's Fred Mazur, who also introduced me to Michael Krause, curator of the museum that'll be sharing Eddie Mazur's World War II story with visitors in the future. He was kind enough to make some time for us as well. So, Michael, what is the Soldiers and Sailors Hall in Pittsburgh? Where did it come from? Why does it exist? And what do people see when they arrive?
Soldiers and Sailors Memorial Hall and Museum opened in 1910. It was built by Civil War veterans who petitioned the county of Allegheny in western Pennsylvania to erect a memorial to their service. So, you know, this is almost 50 years out from the end of the Civil War, and these men are growing older, and they wanted this type of a memorial left to the community. And it's a very large building. It's a historic landmark. There's an auditorium in the center with 2,300 seats, flanked by hallways, and around the hallways are around 40 display cases, tall display cases built into niches, and that's where we display our artifacts. But above the auditorium is a ballroom, and most famously, Silence of the Lambs was filmed there. Some of the scenes from Silence of the Lambs filmed there. We've always been a memorial to American service personnel, starting with the Civil War. We feel like the Civil War veterans passed it down to the Spanish-American War veterans, the World War I veterans, World War II veterans, Korea and Vietnam, and now the current conflict. So people started giving us stuff in 1910. and continue to do so today, like the Mazur family recently. They give us artifacts or mementos or pieces of uniforms, medals, letters, photographs. A lot of it we can display, but probably most of it is in our archive. And we look at ourselves as a way to preserve their memories, the service people's memory, by housing, storing, and caring for these artifacts, making them available, some of them on display and some for researchers or people to come and see. We really try to honor the memory of anybody who wore a uniform from the Civil War till today.
So when you get something on a Gold Star hero like Eddie Mazur, killed in the line of duty 75 years ago this month, how heavy of a responsibility is that to showcase that in a way that does justice to what that person did? And how do you expect that to unfold there at Soldiers and Sailors?
It is a big responsibility. Families bring us things that are very meaningful. And it sometimes takes a lot of time for a family to decide to give up these type of things. Look at Eddie. I mean, his Purple Heart is here. The contents of his locker on board the Ticonderoga, including all the paperwork listing what was there, his letters, some books from childhood and school and photographs. And, you know, that represents to a family the whole from the missing soldier. So we look at it as a big responsibility. And we, of course, can't make a display out of everything, but we do take a lot of care in documenting, archiving, numbering, photographing, recording, and putting these things the things that we don't display away so that they can be retrieved and looked at. And we don't know when that'll be. You know, that might be next week we'll do a display with a certain theme, or it might be 10 years from now when there is another curator and another administration here and they're looking for themes. So our job is to preserve in a dignified way and to interpret and to make available those kind of things.
Well, in light of that, maybe this is a tough one to answer, but that's what I was going to ask next, is when do you expect a display honoring Eddie Mazur to be something folks visiting the Soldiers and Sailors Memorial Hall can actually see and experience there?
Well, when this material came in, the whole family came with it. It was great. We all sat down and looked at everything piece by piece and talked about their memories. And we have, I think I mentioned, about 40 niche display spaces in our building, and they go chronologically through military time frame. Our Navy displays are in need of upgrading. And when this material walked in, my thought right away was, this is a great thing. Eddie's stuff is a great story to tell, and it would be wonderful for people to see these things. So it's targeted to go into a display, and that may take us 2 years to get it there, because we need to remove the old pieces, redo the cabinets, and then write labels and build stands for this stuff. But I see his story being featured in the time frame of 2 years here at Soldiers and Sailors.
And maybe it's a little early to answer this one since you haven't put it together yet, but is there an element to his story or the display that's going to tell his story that you expect to really get people's attention or draw them in or give them a perspective on World War II and the men and women who carried it out that maybe they didn't have before?
Yeah, I mean, we try to focus on the person and then the history that that person brings with them, rather than, you know, the war and then the person. We're looking at the person and then what that person passed through. So there are some things that are really evocative, like his Purple Heart, of course, his uniforms that he had. And some of this was compiled by the family after his death. It wasn't with him at the time of death. But one thing particularly kind of tugs at your heartstrings are some little gifts that he had sent his mother, some perfume and a few pins, and they're on a box, and it says, "Gifts from Eddie." And, you know, if we tell Eddie's story, and also the backstory of him being an athlete and a gymnast, so there's some material here, including a gymnastics jersey that he wore and a photograph of him wearing it, that we can make a person out of him and somehow bring people closer to him and even to this day feel his loss.
And I'm sure, you know, when you run into people, you get questions about what you do and why you do it. So you probably have a good answer for this one. Why, in your mind, is it important that the stories of our veterans be shared today, even if it's 75 years ago, in your case, when some of your displays go back to the Civil War? Why is it important that people today
have that kind of knowledge and information?
Because we have to know that these were real people and not just pictures and books and dates. We have to know that, you know, they grew up and they had families and they went to school and they played. And when the time came, they enlisted and served their country. Many of them didn't come back. And the ones that did come back had to fit back into the world, you know, that they had left, maybe with the effect that their service took on them, or like World War II veterans who just kind of, you know, put it aside and kept going. But I think it's important for people to know that in a continuum, that these were people like you and me, and not just characters or movie stars or statues in a park, but they were really real people. And I think that's the most valuable thing about what we need to remember about them. And then as people, we can look at them in their experiences in these historic events. I know you're a long way from Pittsburgh, but if people ever come here, this place is really worth seeing, and I would encourage them to look at our website. It's soldiersandsailorshall.org. I think they would be pleased to know what we do here and that this place exists. We're pretty unique, and I'd love to share it with folks from California or anywhere in the country, so please come and see us.
I'm going to make a point to do that, and I hope wherever you're listening today, I hope you'll consider doing so as well. I don't know about you, but the story we heard today reminds me that it's never too late to act upon that curiosity or that tug on your heart when it comes to a loved one's service to our country. There are always more layers of that onion to peel away, and so often you end up finding something you didn't expect to find. Thanks again to Bob Mettauer. We'll be praying for you, Bob, and look forward to celebrating when you reach that 100,000-mile mark as Bicycle Bob in Santa Maria. Thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.